Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I have a very special guest with me this week. He is a three-time Tony Award winner for his orchestrations for In the Heights, Dear Evan Hansen, and Hamilton. It is Alex Lockamore. Hi, Alex.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And Alex has more than just three Tony Awards. He has four Grammys, two Oliviers, an Emmy, and a Kennedy Center Honors, amongst many other credits, including a couple of Broadway shows like Legally Blonde and Bring It On, as well as an off-Broadway show that I did not know was on your resume, but I saw it and I was like, oh my God, I love Bat Boy. And I saw your name and I was like, oh my God, I love Bat Boy. I didn't know he was involved with that.
I'm so glad. That was my first big break.
I loved the show when I saw it in New York. He also obviously was involved in the films The Greatest Showman and Vivo. And like me, he was born in Los Angeles. He's a native Los Angelino, although he does not live here anymore. Yeah. And you actually moved when you were quite young, right?
I was 9 years old.
Yeah. You moved to Florida, I believe.
Miami, Florida.
But we are here because we're going to talk about the brand new cast recording for the revival of Sweeney Todd, which is currently playing on Broadway with Josh Groban and Annalee Ashford, which we will talk about some of the exciting news that came out this week about that. The fact that it will be continuing after Josh and Annalee leave, but we'll get to that towards the end. Okay. And before we get to the actual recording, let's talk about your history with Sweeney Todd and the fact that the show actually meant a lot to you when you were young. I think I read that when you were studying piano as a kid, that you got your hands on the score and you became a little obsessed with it.
Yeah, that's accurate. There's something about the way the music fits under the hand on the piano that is just delicious. No pun intended. But I was really just drawn to it. And just musically speaking, I remember first hearing songs from it either at 13 or 15. I can't remember what came first. I either had my piano teacher show me the vocal selections on the piano, or I heard some classmates perform a little priest at a review of songs, theater songs. So I know they all kind of happened at the same time, and my obsession with Sweeney Todd was just huge.
So you obviously have had a connection for it for a long time. So how did you actually become involved with this particular production?
I got a phone call from Tommy Kail, the director of our production. And Tommy was the director of In the Heights and Hamilton. Tommy's one of my best friends. And he knew what Sweeney Todd meant to me as a show. And what I love is that Tommy called me thinking that I was right for it. Because I'm not the person that you think of first when you think of a Sondheim revival. I feel like I'm known as the pop rock guy and contemporary music. But I have a deep love for Sondheim's music, particularly for this show. So I just jumped at the chance to do it because I've actually never music directed a production of Sweeney Todd, nor have I ever music directed a Sondheim show. And here we are doing my favorite Sondheim show and also my favorite show, full stop.
Right. So
it was a gift. I just never thought I would get a chance to do it because, number one, there's, you know, I've always fancied myself a pianist first, and there's no piano in the score to Sweeney Todd. It's, you know, there's not a piano in the orchestration. And also, I have never really fancied myself this really big, strong conductor, right? I can conduct, and I definitely took lessons and tried to better my conducting skills in order to do this. But I was definitely outside of my comfort zone to do this, but it was one that I welcomed because of my deep love and what I think to be my understanding of the show. And it just seemed to align. So it was written in the stars, I guess.
Right. And this is a big undertaking. I mean, for your first, not only is it your first Sondheim show, but it's also, you're using the original Jonathan Tunick 26 piece orchestrations.
Exactly.
Which is monumental. I mean, I don't know. Most listeners know, I think, that these days, for economic reasons, most Broadway shows do not have 26 piece orchestras. They have much smaller size orchestras these days. So using 26 pieces is a blessing and a gift.
Yeah.
But and in this case, Broadway audiences have not heard this score played on Broadway since the original production with these orchestrations and this many pieces. So it's a huge undertaking. And it's considered, if Sondheim's probably best score. It's his biggest score. probably
it's his most beloved score, I'd say.
Yeah. And I think that's a big hill to climb. And for you, it's a little bit of a change because over the past several years, your focus has been a lot on orchestrations. And here you're the music supervisor. So instead of being orchestrator, you're actually music supervising. Yeah. So talk a little bit about your role as music supervisor on the show and what that involves. And also let's talk a little bit about dealing with the orchestrations, because I know you also got to actually interact with Jonathan Tunick.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And which is an absolute, gift. Because he's a legend in the business.
Absolute legend. Yes. To answer your first question, in terms of the music supervising on this show, that's exactly right. I traditionally do a lot of jobs on a particular show. Like I will be the arranger, the orchestrator, music director, conductor, et cetera, pianist, et cetera. And it was nice on the show to not have to worry so much about those things. It was nice to just teach the music, to just conduct the music, to just see it through and not have to worry about how does this show end? Right. Mm-hmm. Like you don't have to make decisions about I wonder, do we need six violins or four? All that was done. It's just do the show. So I really quite enjoyed that we were given the keys to this really amazing car for us to drive. And it was that was the joy. And you are right. It is not common to have a 26-piece orchestra in a Broadway show, partially for economic reasons, but I also think just for artistic reasons, because not all shows need 26 musicians.
Right.
I warrant that Hamilton did not need more than the 10 musicians that we had in our pit. I think it was a particular sound that we were going for. And, a show like Wicked, absolutely. You got 24 in that one. So that seems about right. Because that show has that scope and that epicness and that magical feeling, et cetera, et cetera. So here's a show, Sweeney Todd, a show that really swings big and a show that I think is epic in nature, a story that is huge, a sound that is huge, vocal arrangements that are huge. So I think that the show succeeds when it has that kind of scope to it, when it has that heft, musically speaking, with a 26-piece orchestra. So getting to work on this with Jonathan Tunick at the ready to answer any questions, at all the rehearsals to give his input and make the sound better just by virtue of him giving us notes and critiques was such a gift because he was the lifeline to the original production. Now, one of the things I didn't mention, one of the challenges for me is that I've not worked on a show where the composer was not with us.
Right.
And it was a big just responsibility that I took on and a big, I don't know what the word is, but, I felt a little intimidated by it a little bit, right? Because here I am trying to make decisions about what I thought Sondheim would have wanted and what he would have been okay with.
Right.
There are times in the show. Oh, please. Yeah.
No, I think that, and I think this technically, if I'm correct, this is the first Broadway revival of a Sondheim show where he was not directly involved in the process. I mean, Company, the Broadway production of the revival of Company, he was involved in the London version of it. So he worked with Marianne Elliott on how that came out. So he was directly involved with that. But with your production, I know he was involved in some of the early talks about it, but he wasn't really there during rehearsals or anything. So this was sort of trying to honor his legacy, I guess, gives you an extra burden to carry.
That's a great way to describe it. Yeah. And I don't know that it felt like a burden as in like, oh my God, I'm scared to handle this, but like, I wanted to do right by Sondheim.
Right.
I wanted to do right by all of us who love the score. And as I mentioned, it's not a style of music that I had done much of before at this level. So obviously, all artists, I think, deal with worthiness conversations, right? So there's always that thing of like, oh my God, will I be able to do this? But I felt that I could. I felt ready for it. I felt like my love for the piece and my belief in it, my understanding of what I could bring to it, made me confident to feel like, okay, I have something to say. I'll be able to do this. And that was, I'm really glad I did, because I can't imagine getting another opportunity to do this show with this caliber of performances, with this director who is my best friend, with this producer who I trust so implicitly. You know, everything was just talk about the stars being aligned. It was just like, this is the way I would have wanted to do Sweeney, with this size orchestra, with these people, with Tunic around. It was all just meant to be.
And the tricky thing always is that, you know, because you're doing such a big, true to Sondheim and true to Tunic production of the show, you still don't want, you still want to do something that's got some freshness to it, that's got, you know, that's got Kale's stamp on it, and that's got, you know what I mean? It's still, you don't want to do a complete replica of the, you know, the Hal Prince production. You want to do something that is your production, but is still staying true to the original intent of Sondheim and everybody involved. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So, I do. And it's not like we were trying to put this concept on it.
No, right? Of course.
Like, again, you know, the company Revival with Katrina Lenk, which I absolutely loved, that was a concept on
exactly
show.
Right.
We weren't trying to do that. We just wanted to honor the piece. And as you said, yes, there's some freshness to it because we're going to have a new costume designer, a new lighting designer, a new set designer. So all that is going to add new elements to the piece. But we were certainly not setting out to reinvent any wheels. It was just, as you said, it was Kale's stamp was going to be however it was that he viewed the piece and saw the piece. And I know that what he brought to it elevated the show and made us look at it in different angles that, you know, were that just give us, as you said, our own stamp for this, show, for our production.
And one of the things I read that you had mentioned in another interview you did, which I thought was really interesting, and I thought was sort of in your interactions with Tunic, was not only that you, it was sort of enlightening for you because it felt like you were kind of learning from him by actually interacting with him and seeing his stuff. But what I really enjoyed seeing the most was how he's become so, even though he orchestrated for a lot of other people, he's so associated with Sondheim. Yeah. And you related to it because you've become so associated with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And you were sort of, you kind of understood that. And you kind of felt, you kind of related to how he has become associated with him, with Sondheim, and you've become associated with Lin. Did that, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I said to Lin a long time ago, years ago, I said, Lin, I just want to be the tunic to your Sondheim. And you know, if people associate us, I consider that an honor. I know, you know, when I talked to Tunick about him meeting Sondheim and how that relationship forged, I remember Tunick saying that he just got Sondheim's music. He just felt like he just understood it. And there's this intrinsic, instinctive connection to Tunick just knowing what Sondheim's music, I don't want to say what it needed, but just like how he fit into it. And that's how I feel about Lin-Manuel's music. I know how it fit into it. And I feel like I know how to get across what Lin is trying to say. Mm-hmm. And that is not something that is easy to do. And that to me feels like a true kinship and the kind of thing that as an artist, I think you look for. You dream about finding a counterpart in that way where you just like fit. And my happiest moments are the times when I feel and see and hear that I have Lin's full trust. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times when we were working, I have this story when we were working on Vivo, and there was a song that Lin had written for the movie called One More Song. And we were together working on it, sitting side by side on the piano. And it was the first time we had really sat down to discuss it. And up until that point, I had only heard Lin's demo of the piece, and we were meeting to work through the song, talk about it, play through it, discuss ideas. And I remember saying to Lin, hey, okay, Lin, on the demo, the song feels like it doesn't quite really reach this apex. I don't feel like the ending has enough of a payoff. And right away, Lin says, oh, yeah, I kind of left it like that because I knew that you would do your thing, like. Mm-hmm. So that was him basically just saying, okay, Alex, you're going to do your thing. I have trust that even if I don't take it all the way, see it to the very, very last millisecond, I can allow you to do that. And I know it's going to come out fine. I know it's going to come out the way I like it. So that to me is the most fulfilling thing that I could hear from someone who I admire and respect as much as Lin, to know that he is leaving that space for me and allowing me to be in that space, because not every composer is that willing to leave that space. Right. Not every composer is willing to welcome a collaborator and name them by name and say, mm-hmm. hey, this person did that. And this person is a part of my journey. Mm-hmm. We all know people who don't do that. So it's a blessing.
What did you find in terms of when you first started tackling Sweeney Todd? Was there anything in the score that you found challenging from teaching teaching it to the cast, or just from a music supervisor position? Because it is a rather challenging score.
It is a challenge.
I've been involved in a couple of productions of the show, and I've had friends who have played. I have known so many Pirellis in my life. Cannot tell you how many of my friends have played Pirelli in different productions.
I believe it.
When I heard the contest, I was like, oh my God, I probably could sing this myself because I had so many friends play this role. But it's sort of the roles in the show. I think it's a little difficult to explain to people because you can sit down and listen to the cast recording, or you can go and see the show, but this is not an easy show.
No,
it is not an easy show for the performers at all. There's a lot of music in the show, and there's a lot of singing in the show, and it requires a lot. The vocals are not easy. They're just not.
That is all true.
And
oh, please.
No. So what were some of the challenges for you?
I think the challenges for me, and they were welcome challenges, was trying to figure out how to have the actors hear the music in a way that would make it sound easy. Mm-hmm. For example, if there's a rhythmic way of hearing certain phrases, like how do you find that rhythm such that you come in the right beat? Mm-hmm. If there are some tricky intervals, what are some tricks to try to find that correct note to sing? Mm-hmm. What is a way to have them sing it and hear it so that it honors the text and honors it and sings it the way it's written? And sometimes I had to do that for myself. There are plenty of passages that I had a hard time just hearing myself and where they fit, like the City on Fire melody. That's tricky. And I myself sat at the piano, played the chords underneath, and had to make my body, my ear, my brain hear where the notes fit inside those chords, because it's not where you think they go. So, you know, I think just it takes practice. It takes repetition. It takes just opening your brain up to be able to hear those things. So I found that to be quite fun. And I enjoy the challenge and the puzzle of trying to help people hear things when they might not hear it. Mm-hmm. Like if there's an actor that just keeps gravitating towards a D flat when it's meant to be a D natural, like how do you work to make them hear that note? How do you find an angle to allow them to be able to hear it such that they could do their best work? So I found that to be really fun.
So let's talk about some of the specific performers, because this is a really unique cast, in the sense that you've got, the lineup in the show is incredibly talented. Yes. And I think you're led by Josh Groban as Benjamin Barker, Sweeney Todd. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting because Josh has such an identifiable pop vocal persona, because he's got so many fans who know him as from his recording career. Mm-hmm. He has done Broadway. We know, I mean, he did Great Comet. He did musical theater and stuff when he was young, but he's got this kind of real pop persona that is not Sweeney Todd. It isn't as dark as Sweeney Todd. And I'm sure you must have been involved in getting him to explore the darker side vocally with him. And it's obviously worked, because he sounds wonderful on the cast recording, and he's got a wonderful, I mean, Josh has always been an amazing singer. Yeah. And here he's really exploring depths that he does not explore in his pop singing. So talk about Josh and the process with him, because I know he really wanted to do this role.
Yes, he's always wanted to do this role. Well, listen, I find Josh's instrument to be powerful. Mm-hmm. I find Josh's instrument to be rich. Mm-hmm. I find his sound to be sonorous and just gorgeous. So whatever medium he's singing in, like, doesn't matter. Those qualities I just named is what you need to sing Sweeney Todd. Mm-hmm. And he just has, like, I think, a heft to his voice, a richness to his voice, a sound that, like, you know, when Josh sings and goes full tilt, like, you can quake in your boots. And I love that. And so one of the things I know, the conversations we would have early on in the process is, like, what is the sound to use for Sweeney when he's performing? And I know we had some great conversations about whether or not Josh needed to darken his tone or add an extra amount of heft to his sound. And I personally found that, like, when Josh really gives a really clear sound, and it's almost like a clarion call, like this really pointed, daggery kind of tone, I thought that was really effective. I didn't think that he needed to add any kind of weight or do anything special. I think he just needed to sound like him. And I think if the story was being told and it was clear and it was unedited and unabashed, because to me, Sweeney Todd, the character, is so sure in what his path is, and so defiant and so confident. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't shirk back. He doesn't pull punches. He just goes for it. So to me, how you translate that sonically, I have thoughts about what that is like. And I really enjoyed discussing with Josh about what that was and how to make sure that he found that, how to make sure that Josh Groban found that he could feel himself in the role and feel fully represented inside the body of Sweeney Todd, inside Benjamin Barker. So I really enjoyed that part.
Yeah. And I think that comes across on the recording really well, because I know sometimes I have seen Sweeneys who, especially in the Epiphany, where they make the choice of either growling or screaming or overdoing the vocals.
Yeah.
And as a result, you can't actually understand the lyrics because, and to me that's, you're not trusting the lyrics and you're not trusting, you know, the lyrics basically are telling you what you need to know. And if you don't sing them clearly, then you're not getting the message across and you're using emotion to substitute for the lyrics. And I don't think that really works. You've got to sing the lyrics.
I particularly love Josh's interpretation of Epiphany. I think he sounds absolutely fantastic on it. And yeah, there are times that he growls and goes for it and yells, but it's all warranted. It's all feels story driven and there's a purpose to
it. But he's also enunciating and you can hear everything.
Yep. Yep.
Because that's how he sings.
He's got the goods.
He's got the goods. You can hear him.
Out. Mr. Todd. Out, I say out!
Oh, this running and shouting. What is it now, dear?
I had him and then...
When that sailor busted in, I saw them both running down the street.
I had him! His throat was there beneath my hand.
There, dear, don't fret.
No, I had him! His throat was there and he'll never come again.
Easy now! Hush, love, hush! I keep telling you, what's your rush?
Why can I wait? You told me to wait. Now he'll never come again. There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the ones with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. No, we all deserve to die. Even you, Mrs. Lovett, even I. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you, sir, how about a shave? Come in, visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you bleeders. You, sir? Anybody? Gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man. No, nor 10 men. Nor 100 can assuage. Even as he gloats, in the meantime I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm full of joy.
And speaking of singing, let's talk about Anna Lee, because I think one of the things people forget about Anna Lee is that she's a wonderful singer and she's very, very funny. She's got the comedic chops as good as anybody in the business, and she can deliver comedy with her one hand tied behind her back. She's so funny. She's so funny. And people forget she can sing. She can really sing. And I think
this is a hard score to sing.
It is a hard score to sing.
Wonderful.
And I think what people, because I mean, I'll be honest with you. I was hesitant to listen to the cast recording because some people were complaining about they didn't love Anna Lee's version of Mrs. Lovett. And I was like, I couldn't. And I was like, really? I'm kind of surprised. And so then when I listened to it, I was like, and it suddenly dawned on me why some people found it a little jarring. And I said, and I realized, I think it's because they're not used to hearing a Mrs. Lovett who can sing. actually can sing the score because they're so used to having a Mrs. Lovett who is a wonderful actress who does character work really well, who sings fine. Do you know what I mean? And do you know what I'm saying? I mean, Angela Lansbury is an actress who sings. She's not a she's not a fabulous vocalist. She's wonder. She's fine. We love her interpretation of it, but she's always in character and she's not a vocalist of the same caliber as Annalee Ashford. She's not. And Annalee sings her way through the score. And I think it was a little odd for me when I first heard it too, because I'm so used to hearing someone like Angela Lansbury or some of the other interpretations I've heard on recordings where they're a little bit more character-y all the time. And and Annalee's holding her notes and she's singing through the phrases. And a lot of the Mrs. Lovett's don't do that. And it gives you a different Mrs. Lovett. And I
think there's something. Sorry.
No, that's fine. And I appreciated that. I enjoyed it.
I'm glad. Yeah, there's something about the way Annalee delivers it. It's like her voice to me is so clear. Mm-hmm. And she has a way of making it sound effortless. Those are some high notes that she sings. But to me, it always sounds like Annalee. It always sounds like her. I don't hear her struggling. And I think that's what I love. I hear her telling the story. I hear her emoting. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite parts as the producer of a cast album is comping the vocals. And that is the act of choosing which takes you want to lead with, right? Because so imagine that we've got takes upon takes upon takes of Worst Prize in London, right? And we might have maybe five full takes of the song front to back, but then we'll have an additional five takes of just these four bars, an additional 10 takes of these eight bars. So by the end, you're listening to take 95 of something. And what I love is that when you listen to Annalee's takes, all of them are charged. All of them have like oomph to it. The same thing with Josh. Like there's such, it's like an embarrassment of riches where everything just sounds like powerful, evocative, emotional, honest. Mm-hmm. And there's something about Annalee's sound and tone that is all those things, honest and real. And, you know, it was a joy to hear her interpret it. And just like you said, it's a joy to hear Mrs. Lovett sung to me so cleanly and so well and so effortless in a way that is still servicing the story.
Right.
So I applaud them both.
Yeah, I actually really enjoyed her performance. I really, really did. And I was surprised because, and I did, like I said, I've loved Mrs. Lovett is such a great character.
It is.
And she's, I know a lot of actresses love to sink their teeth into that character. But it was really nice to hear someone sing it and really sing it. And speaking of people who can really sing, Ruthie Ann Miles is just amazing. Yeah. I've seen her multiple times on stage and she's one of these people who she can take what I think people might consider the smallest of featured roles and turn it into magic because she has this tone and nuance to her voice and how she interprets songs.
Yeah.
And even though I have not seen this production of Sweeney Todd, just in her vocals as the bigger woman, she's bringing something totally different to the bigger woman than I have ever heard on a recording.
I feel the same way.
There's just something about the way Ruthie sings. It's just, can you talk about working with her on this? Because everybody I know who saw the show said, I have never seen a bigger woman as good as Ruthie Ann Miles. I just haven't.
I agree. So again, you know, I keep saying this about all the performers we have in this show, but Ruthie's voice has clarity to it. Mm-hmm. And she's able to disguise her voice and have it be different. And she has a way of maneuvering through these different stylistic choices vocally. Mm-hmm. And there are times on the cast album, there's a passage that she sings in Joanna Act Two sequence that to me is blood curdling. And it sounds shrieky, but it sounds like, you know, she's got total control over what she's doing, but it sounds untethered and it sounds manic and out of control. So I love that danger in her voice. Mm-hmm. And there's a way that she just left it all, you know, she left it all on the floor for this recording. And to be able to work with her on this was just a dream because she also wants to get it right. Mm-hmm. Talk about wanting to do right by Sondheim. She wanted every note to be clean and clear. And she has, she's such a good musician that she's able to hear and sing these complicated intervals and these hard rhythms. So again, she makes it feel effortless. So working with her has been an absolute delight.
Again, my little dove, my sweet Joanna.
Joanna.
Goodbye, Joanna. You're gone, and yet you're mine. I'm fine, Joanna.
Joanna.
I'm
fine.
Smoke, smoke. Sign of the devil, sign of the devil. City on fire. Witch, witch. Smell it, sir, an evil smell. Every night at the Vespers bell. Smoke that comes from the mouth of hell. City on fire. City on fire. Mischief, mischief, mischief.
And if I never hear your voice, my turtle dove, my dear, I still have reason to rejoice. The way ahead is clear, Joanna. And in that darkness when I'm blind with what I can't forget, it's always morning in my mind, my little lamb, my pet, Joanna.
Somebody look up there. Didn't I tell you smell that air? City on fire. Quick, miss, run and tell. Warn them all of the witches' spell. There it is the unholy spell. Tell them the bill of the police as well. Tell them, help. Then, city on fire. City on fire. Mischief, mischief, mischief.
Of you, I guess, until the day I die. I think I miss you less and less as every day goes by. Joanna. And you'd be beautiful and pale and look too much like her. If only angels could prevail, we'd be the way we were, Joanna.
Joanna.
Wake up, Joanna. Another bright red day. we learn, Joanna, to say,
talk about, now that we're actually talking about the recording in depth, talk about, because this is such a huge show to record, I think I looked at it, I think it was like more than 90 minutes worth of music on
just
the recording. Yeah.
On there's a lot. Album, yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot to record. Talk about the, because I don't know that the listeners always know what goes into doing a cast recording.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. The logistics of scheduling musicians and performers and trying to get this all done is very, it's difficult even when you're just doing a regular Broadway show that's yeah. coming in with just one, you know, one 45, one, you know, 70 minute or 65 minute album. But when right. you're doing something as monumental as Sweeney Todd with 26 pieces and a huge cast, talk about the logistics and getting this thing recorded.
Sure. I mean, I feel like it would take 2 hours just to talk about it all.
I know,
I'll try to condense it as best I can, but it starts with the simple act of just deciding what you're going to record.
Right. Because there are cuts that have to be made.
Right. And I was not interested in recreating the 1979 original. That is yeah. what it is. And mm-hmm. there are bits of music that you will hear on the original 1979 that we chose not to do because I wanted this to be a different kind of listening experience. Mm-hmm. Because again, I'm thinking about this, the world of Apple Music and Spotify, where people don't necessarily listen to an album front to back. Like, what's the moment that we start the track where people will be engaged and right. enjoying the experience? So I try to balance all that. But there was the act of mapping out all the click tempos ahead of time, because all of this was recorded the click, because I decided ahead of time that I wanted to record the orchestra and the cast separately. There's the act of deciding when to record, how many days. And we did it over the course of 3 days on the days off from the show schedule. So mm-hmm. the musicians finished a show on Sunday afternoon, recorded all day Monday from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., all day Tuesday, same schedule, Wednesday morning, followed by two shows that same day at the
mm-hmm.
We recorded vocals separately and not all together. Like, there was one day that I brought in just Jordan and Maria to record their passages. Another day that I brought in Josh and Annalie to record theirs. So the vocals were staggered. So mm-hmm. the challenge is to create the illusion that Josh and Jamie Jackson were in the room to record Pretty Women together, even though they were not.
Right.
Then there's the act of choosing takes from the vocals, as I mentioned, mixing them, you know, meeting over Zoom with my engineers who live in California while I'm in New York, and I'm listening to the track and saying, okay, let's raise the level of the French horn for that one bar. Let's add more reverb to the strings, all those choices. Then adding vocals to that as well, making sure we hear the lyric every time, discussing the panning, like, do I want the vocals on the left or do I want them on the right? You know, do I want to add reverb to the beggar woman's voice mm-hmm. as she exits the song to make it sound like she's walking off stage, all these studio things that you add. And that takes a lot of planning. That takes lots of hours.
Right.
And this was an album that I, you know, we started tracking in April and it did not get released digitally into September. So we're talking yes. about a 5-month process because it was so massive, because I went in with a scalpel to chisel out every detail with the engineers, because I wanted it to be right, because I would not rest until I thought it was quote unquote perfect. You know, I had a high bar to mm-hmm. reach for in that 1979 original. And I wanted to make sure that our version has something to offer and that our version honored the score and our production. So a lot goes into making a cast album, but fortunately, I've enjoyed the process enough with the other records I've made that I now feel well-versed in what it takes to make it happen. And I feel equipped to make decisions along the way that will serve our album. And I'm glad I got to do it.
Yeah, it was. I know that it was a long, definitely a long process, because I know fans were getting impatient because they were like, why is this taking so long? Why is this? We know it was recorded. Why is it taking so long? And people, and that's the thing. I think people kept chiming in saying, this is a big album. This is a lot of music. It takes a lot of time to get this kind of album put together. It's not just a quickie turnaround. It's not a small off-Broadway show where it's, you know, five musicians and, you know, three vocalists. It's not that quick. And it takes a long time.
I think people thought that the album was done and that we were just releasing a track at a time and everything else was just sitting in a vault waiting for something.
Right. I think, I remember when it was finally getting released and Josh put that video out where he was sort of apologetic saying, I know you guys thought we were torturing you and that we were slowly releasing tracks one at a time just to bother you. But it wasn't really like that. It was taking this long.
No, we were releasing tracks as they were done.
Yeah, I know. And I don't think people realize that. I was like, I felt so bad. I was like, you guys don't understand. They're trying to keep you guys happy by releasing stuff one track at a time. And people were getting so upset. They're like, just release it. Just release it.
No. We weren't done. We weren't done.
I know.
Thank you for seeing it.
So do you, now that it's out, a couple of questions. Do you have a favorite moment either in the show when you're watching the show? Is there a favorite moment for you in the show, or is there a favorite moment on the cast recording that you just love hearing?
Oh, wow, that's a great question. You know, a fun number for me is God That's Good on the cast album, just because it's so, you know, goes between all these scenes and Mrs. Lovett is being pulled in all these different directions. But I feel like that's a hard song to get right, but I love the way our ensemble sang it because they feel like totally clean and they got all the notes. Same thing with both performances, Josh and Annalie and Gayton, all the principals. I think they're all just beautifully sung and beautifully recorded.
May I have your attention, please? Are your nostrils a quivering, tingling as well, like the delicate, luscious, ambrosial smell? Yes, they are, I can tell. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that aroma enriching the breeze is like nothing compared to its succulent sources. The gourmets among you will tell you, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't imagine the rapture in store just inside of this door. There you'll sample Mrs. Lovett's meat pies, savory and sweet pies, as you'll see. You who eat pies, Mrs. Lovett's meat pies, conjure up the treat pies used to be. Over here, boy, how about some ale?
Let me have another side of way.
Could we ask some service, waiter? What about this high bottle of rye, boys,
ladies?
Howdy!
Coming, excuse me.
Ale there!
Right, mum.
Quick now.
God, that's good.
Nice to see you, dearie. How have you been keeping?
Call me mum since weary.
Gentlemen, hear the birdies cheeping, helps to keep it cheery. Toby, throw the old woman out.
God, that's good.
What's your pleasure, dearie? Now we don't cut slices. Call me eyes as bleary. Toby, none for the gentlemen. I cut up me prices. I'm a little leery. Business couldn't be better though.
God, that's good.
Knock on wood.
Psst. Excuse me. Please see to the customers. Yes, what love, quick, though the trade is brisk.
But at 6 o'clock.
So it's 6 o'clock.
It was due to arrive at 4:45
and
at 6 o'clock.
And it's probably already down the block. It'll be here,
I've been waiting all day. But it should have been here by now.
Will
you wait?
You'll come back when it comes.
Because my customers truly are getting unruly. Oh, what's your pleasure, dearie? Whoops, I beg your pardon. Just me hands are smeary. Toby, run for the gentleman. Don't you love our garden? Always makes me teary. Must be one of the foreigners.
God, that's good. That is delicious.
What's my secret? Frankly, dear, forgive me. Can the family secret all to do with herbs? Things like being careful with your coriander. That's what makes the gravy grander.
More hot pies! More hot, more pies!
Excuse me. Please, see to the customers. What? Now, love, quick, go, the trade is brisk. is wet.
Coming up the stairs.
I'll get rid of this loss. There's two pretty hearts.
It's about to be opened. Don't you care?
Never be, never
but we
will
have
be,
to prepare.
Never be so different. I'm get cold. Oh, it's a deadly deary. You know Mrs. Mooney. Sales have been so dreary. Toby, poor thing is penniless. What about that loony? Look, it's all a beery. Oh, well, gotta come up and say that'll be frappin'.
God, that's good. That she's sheet. Have you licious ever tasted? Smell such. Oh, my God. What more? That's price good.
Ooh.
Is that a chair fit for a king? A wondrous, neat, and most particular chair. You tell me, where is there a seat can half compare with this particular thing? I have a few minor adjustments to make. They'll take a moment. I'll call you. I have another friend.
Is that a pie fit for a king? A wondrous, sweet, and most particular thing. You see, Bob, why there is no meat pie can compete with this delectable pie. The crust, all velvety and wavy, that glaze, those crimps, and then the thick succulent pie.
Quick now.
Me heart's a flutter.
When I pound the floor.
When you pound the floor.
It's a signal to show that
yes,
I'm ready
me,
to go.
I know
when
be
I pound
ready to
the floor.
Go when you pound the floor. Will you trust me? Will
I just want to be sure.
I'll be waiting for long
when
for
I'm
the
certain that you're in place. I'll pound three times. Three times. And then you. Three times. If you. Exactly.
More hot pies.
Hot.
More hot.
In the show, gosh, I always enjoy Pretty Women. I think that's such a wonderful moment. Just that whole stretch in the show between Pretty Women going into Epiphany, going to a little priest, like what a great way to end an act. I know conducting wise, I always particularly enjoy conducting Not While I'm Around because that's such a beautiful song, mm-hmm. such a beautiful orchestration. I have different right. moments and they vary.
Yeah. And Not While I'm Around is such a, it's one of my favorite moments in the show because it's such a strange moment in the show. It's, you know, it's this moment where Sondheim has written this gorgeous song that's lullaby-ish, but it's also terrifying because of we know what's happening and we know what's potentially going to happen. And you can, it's even in the lyrics. I mean, you can just kind of see what's happening and it's all just kind of underneath the surface. And it's a beautiful song to listen to, but in the context of the show, it's really scary.
That's one of the best things about Sweeney. Like the most beautiful music happens under the most terrifying circumstances.
Exactly. So what's the response been like now that the album's out?
You know, I don't listen online. I think
well, you can't go online. You have to hear it from people, you know, who have listened to it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So what I have heard is that people are happy that it's out. What I've heard is that people are enjoying the performances. You know, I like I said, I just wanted to do Proud by Sondheim and the mm-hmm. show. So, you know, the rest will take care of itself. And my hope is that people recognize the effort that we put into it, that people acknowledge that this is a special mm-hmm. time, that as you mentioned, this is the first time that Sweeney has been done on Broadway with a, you know, with a ensemble this large, with an orchestra this large. So yeah, I think it's a cause for celebration, and I think people are enjoying that.
It's also part of this crazy Sondheim wave we're having with Merrily is like selling like gangbusters. I mean, those box office numbers for Merrily are absolutely insane.
Isn't that interesting? Like Sondheim, crazy. After, you know, having his heart broken by the reception of Merrily when it came out, to know that it's now a hit, like I think he would have been really delighted.
Yeah. And then Here We Are is playing at the Shed, and it's all sorts of things are happening. And I'm going to be seeing those shows in November when I'm there at the beginning of November. So that'll be good.
Wonderful.
And Sweeney, of course, is playing. And we just got word this week that Josh and Anna Lee will be leaving in mid-January, which mm-hmm. I think everyone was kind of expecting, with that their contracts would be up about that time. And I know Josh probably has things that he needs to get back to doing, like touring and things like that. And I know that a lot of people were kind of expecting, oh, well, Sweeney probably will close when they're once they're gone. But the word came out that the show is going to continue. And that the roles will be recast. Mm-hmm. And I know you're not going to tell me who they're going to recast them with, unless you want to tell me when we're off mic. My lips are sealed. You could give us some hints. And I also heard a rumor that there might be a West End production of the show, but you don't have to confirm that. I heard that rumor this week also, but we can talk about that off mic as well. But let's talk about what's coming up next for you, because I believe you're working on a show with Michael Greif and Gloria Estefan. Is that coming up?
Yes, I am. I've hopped on board to work on a musical that Gloria is writing along with her daughter, Emily Estefan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And listen, Gloria is an icon. I adore her. I got to work with her on Vivo. So the thought of doing something with her thrills me and delights me. And doing a show with Michael Greif, who is a director who I admire and I trust, is nice to be able to work with people that I enjoy working with. So that is the dream. So that has no real hard dates. It's still very early process, but I'm happy to be on board.
Yeah. And what is the quick synopsis of the story? It sounded really good. It sounded really interesting.
Yeah. It centers around an orchestra in a town in Paraguay. The town is called Cateura, mm-hmm. and Cateura is basically a huge, huge, huge landfill city. All the trash from Asunción, which is the capital of Paraguay, goes to this really impoverished town of Cateura. Mm-hmm. And the poverty there is so immense that there's an orchestra made up of children who play instruments made out of recycled garbage.
Right.
So it is violins that are made out of used oil cans. It is the tuning pegs on the harps are made out of coins and keys, you know, like house keys and car keys. Mm-hmm. The keys for the saxophone are made out of bottle caps, that kind of stuff. So it's really amazing how even in the poorest of circumstances, art and music can be a beacon. Mm-hmm. So the story will be centered around that.
Perfect. It sounded really fascinating when I read about it. So congratulations on that. Look forward to hearing more as it gets developed. And congratulations, of course, on the cast recording of Sweeney Todd, which is now out and available. And do you have an online presence where people can follow you and see what you're doing?
Yes. Instagram is what I use most frequently. That's mm-hmm. A Lacamoire. I do have an X account, but I've not really been using it. I just lurk on that.
Okay.
But that's at Lackety Lack.
Okay. So I'll send people to your Instagram account so they can find you.
That's great. Yeah.
So, Alex, I appreciate you taking the time to chat.
My pleasure, gentlemen.
It's been a joy to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Much continued success. And hopefully, if people are in New York, please catch Sweeney Todd. If you can see it before Josh and Anna Lee leave in January, that's great. But if you can't, there will be just as good Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett coming in after they leave, I guarantee you, these producers are going to get wonderful replacements. They will. So buy your tickets for Sweeney Todd. And also make sure you pick up the album. Is this coming? This is, I can't remember. Is this out on physical?
It will be very soon.
Very soon. Okay. So they can pick up, because I know people like to add CDs to their collection.
Yes,
so,
of course.
So there will be physical CDs. But in the meantime, please, and please, please, please purchase the download. Don't just stream it on the music services. Uh-huh. Purchase the download, because that gives people money, not the streaming. And as I always tell my listeners, take the time, the 90 minutes, to sit and listen from beginning to end. Don't pick and choose different tracks. I know that everybody likes to do that, but as I preach to my listeners all the time, people like Alex put these albums together to has a listening experience. You pick it up and you start from the beginning and you sit and listen to the end. You have 90 minutes of your day to set aside to listen to Sweeney Todd. So listen to it from beginning to end. Thank you, Alex.
Have a lovely day.
Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around. Nothing's gonna harm you, no sir, not while I'm around. Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays. I'll send them howling, I don't care, I got ways.
Of course you do. What a sweet, affectionate child it is.
No one's gonna hurt you, no one's gonna dare. Others can desert you, not to worry, whistle, I'll be there. Demons will charm you with a smile for a while. But in time, nothing can harm you, not while I'm around.
What is this foolishness? What are you talking about?
Not to worry, not to worry. I may not be smart, but I ain't dumb. I can do it, put me to it. Show me something I can overcome. Not to worry, mum. Being close and being clever ain't like being true. I don't need to, I would never hide a thing from you. Like so.
Now Toby dear, haven't we had enough foolish chatter? Let's just sit nice and quiet for a bit. Nothing's gonna harm you, not while I'm around. Nothing's gonna harm you, darling, not while I'm around.
Demons are prowling everywhere nowadays. I'll send them howling, I don't care.
Boys and their fancies, what will we think of next?
No one's gonna hurt you, no one's gonna dare. Others can desert you, not to worry, whistle, I'll be there. Demons will charm you with a smile.